All right, finally, I've had the time to sit down and make this Patreon exclusive episode. I've been just so busy with so many different things and being asked to go on a couple of different shows, like Glenn Greenwald, like Macaroni and Cheese, and a couple of others. And yeah, now I'm finally able to do it. So let's get on it. So for this episode, you guys had the choice between blockchain and the metaverse, or my thoughts on proof of work versus proof of stake. And the second one won out. So that's the episode we're going to do. To be honest, it also took me a while to do this because it required quite a bit more research than I originally thought. I had to rethink a bit what I was thinking in the beginning, and sort of redo it a bit. Like at first, I was trying to make a lot of very direct comparisons with like a Marxist framework on class positions within proof of work or proof of stake networks, but it felt a bit too constraining, and it required me eventually to force myself to think a little bit differently. But so I think it'll become a bit more clear as we go on. The first thing that we should start off, I think, is understanding proof of work, since proof of work is the first consensus mechanism used for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. And so proof of work was actually originally a cryptographic proofing mechanism that was originally meant to prevent spam email. So as a sender of data, you need to prove that you've done some amount of computational work. And by doing that, you can sort of slow down the amount of email that is being like sent to someone else's email, so it like slows down spam a bit. That was like the original intent of it, and it has big use of hashes. So a hash, in case you don't know, is a one-way function in which you can give any input, and you will always create a fixed size output as a way to save memory, as a way to hide messages. There's a lot of reasons why you might want to do that. And hashing is used in many different cases for many different things, and is, I think, a good example of how we should also think about crypto or blockchain. That's, one type of technology can have many uses for many different things in many different contexts, and it's sort of up to us to think about what type of context we want to use it in for our political goals, but that's a whole other conversation for a bit later. So if we look now at proof of work when it comes to the cryptocurrency world, and Bitcoin and any other cryptocurrency that use proof of work, the purpose of proof of work is, of course, to have some sort of double spend protection. So it uses the proof of work, which is sort of meant to prevent spam email, to prevent the ability for people to double spend. And it's also used by figuring out these cryptographic hashes, these cryptographic mathematical puzzles. You also get rewarded in Bitcoin, so that creates a type of inflationary mechanism as well, up until, the point that it stops making more Bitcoin. In the case of Bitcoin, there's a max cap of 21 million. But so this inflationary thing is just sort of tacked on top of proof of work as a way to economically incentivize the upkeep of the network itself. This is opposed to proof of stake, which is a different consensus mechanism in which, rather than trying to prevent double spending through proof of some amount of digital work or digital computation, instead you have stakers as opposed to miners in the case of proof of work. Stakers stake, or they provide collateral of the actual cryptocurrency that is native to that blockchain. And so, of course, because of this situation, proof of stake uses, some say, like 99.9% less energy than proof of work does, because it's using a completely different mechanism for preventing double spending and for allowing the network to come to consensus. But what I want to focus on for this episode is more on the political economy, which is implied by what these systems or consensus mechanisms are trying to achieve. What's important to point out, though, is that with both of these types of consensus mechanisms, they are still heavily dependent on the context in which they're existing, i.e., they're very, very dependent on capitalism, or the fact that they work even is big reason is because of capitalism. It is because like there is this incentivize that you can incentivize people with these mechanisms through financial value. That isn't to say that both of these mechanisms are essentially the same thing, just because they both rely on capitalism and they rely on sort of profit-seeking maximizers to sort of take care of their network. But I think there are really important distinctions that need to be made when comparing both of these two. And so the best sort of metaphor that I've been able to think of when thinking about proof of work versus proof of stake is kind of, and this isn't like a perfect metaphor to be, I mean, no metaphor is really ever perfect, but to think of proof of work as sort of industrial capitalism and proof of stake as financial capitalism. So if we continue with this metaphor and think about it in a historical lens, it can arguably be said that actually financial capitalism was before industrial capitalism in the form of sort of like mercantile sort of financial capital. This was really like the beginnings of maybe a little bit of capitalism, some might say, during feudalism. But industrial capitalism was certainly before financial capitalism in becoming hegemonic and becoming really, really big, until only like fairly recently, especially with neoliberalism, I think financial capitalism has sort of like won out that sort of battle. You still have, of course, many different, large industries with a lot of power under capitalism. And I think when we talk about capitalism or think about capitalism, you have to think about many different capitalisms sort of like happening at the same time and sort of overlapping with one another with slightly different interests. This we can sort of think of as well as just like the intra-bourgeois conflicts that arise, so just different business interests having conflicts with one another every once in a while. You see this especially in American politics. Basically, a different set of capitalists support Democrats and another set support Republicans. And that's ultimately what the political stage is sort of allowing for discussion. So like, then you can say from there, because both parties sort of represent capitalist interests, we are under a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie of capitalists, because there is no, I mean, especially in the US, there is no working class party that really legislates and really fights for working class interests. But as soon as, of course, you had someone like Bernie Sanders, who did advocate for working class interests to a certain extent, you saw that both Republicans and Democrats sort of came together to make sure that Bernie Sanders would not be elected as president or as the candidate for the Democratic Party. And that's because their class interests aligned on that issue. But anyways, when thinking about industrial capitalism, we can think of sort of the most typical way that capitalism is sort of defined, in that it's sort of it's an economic and social system in which capitalists use the private ownership of their property, production, and assets, and then they use that power dynamic to employ workers, in which they pay workers less than the amount of money that they make off of selling the commodities that are produced by the workers. And usually workers need to use the technology, the industrial technology, in order to create the commodities that are then sold on the market. And so I think, especially during Karl Marx's time, industrial capitalism was, he was alive during the Industrial Revolution. Industrial capitalism was the main form of capitalism that I think he was critiquing, and is unsurprisingly the form of capitalism that sort of goes best with Marx's definitions and critiques, likely. Now, I say this because I found an interesting article that was written back in around 2018, written by Dmitry Kleiner, who is one of the main guys behind Telekommunisten. And in the piece, he critiques libertarians on Bitcoin and their inability of being able to explain where the value of Bitcoin comes from. And he actually says that, ironically, the labor theory of value by Marx was actually much better at understanding where the value of Bitcoin comes from. He's saying that if what they want to make out of Bitcoin is this sort of commodity money over the internet, so a digital commodity of money that is similar to gold, at least, Bitcoin doesn't actually achieve that because of the lack of link between the inflation and the amount of labor or computational power, essentially, that's being put into proof of work. And so he proposes that if Bitcoin were to become more rational and to become actually more like gold, I think it would have to adjust their inflation mechanism to be correlated with the amount of computational power or labor that is being put into the creation of this commodity. Now, I don't really agree 100% with everything that was said in the article, but I found it pretty interesting. And then I read another article by Martin Tremchinsky, I think how you say it. He's a Czech academic, and he did this whole sort of analysis of Bitcoin from looking at it in the point of view of Marx and the labor theory of value, and as well Antonio Negri, the affective theory of value. But in that paper, he talks about the class position within the proof of work system. So what are the classes within proof of work in Bitcoin? And he had this interesting quote. He said, miners, as performing the labor for upkeep of the network, the miners are thus locked in ever-speeding spiral of labor and expenditure. Consequently, some miners become workers employed at the mining farms, others join the lean platforms of mining pools, still others manage to open their own mining farms, have employees, and thus occupy the contradictory class locations. The competitive mode of distribution of new bitcoins makes them subsumed to the power of capital because to realize at least a promise of future profits, they have to conform with the investor's expectations. So like whenever I was first thinking about what are class positions within the Bitcoin network, I almost kind of instinctively or reflexively wanted to think of miners as kind of the capitalists. But actually, I think according to Martin, I think he raises a really good point, is actually way more complicated than that. Miners are performing some amount of work, right? The proof of work, they're performing labor with the use of their mining machines. However, they're in a weird position because in order for them to be profitable, they also have to sell their Bitcoin on the market so that they can make money to keep continuing their operations. So while on one side, I think you could argue that miners have a lot of control over the network and have the power to sort of like collude with one another. I think that's sort of why I thought of them as capitalists, and as well, the Bitcoin mining operations are just really, really big industrial operations that clearly the operations themselves and the private property of the mining equipment and of the spaces that they may use is probably owned by some sort of capitalists. Within the Bitcoin network, it's clear that miners are also sort of laborers, or at least they employ laborers in the form of their graphics cards to upkeep the network. And so they have this contradictory class position within the network, and because there is this overlaying of different capitalisms on top of each other that sort of make it a lot more confusing and not easy to say, like, miners are this and users are this. Miners and users or investors are two distinct classes within the network, but they don't necessarily fit the Marxist framework very cleanly. But what's interesting to note is that I think Dmitry Kleiner and Martin and like the and libertarians also as well are sort of thinking of Bitcoin as a commodity, whereas I think Dmitry and libertarians both have, not that they necessarily have, but they are using in that analysis a type of commodity theory of money. But as well, with the proof of work system used in Bitcoin, at least there are only more or less two distinct class positions when it comes to the network. With proof of stake, it's a little bit more complicated as well, because there are many different types of proof of stakes and there are many different ways that you can arrange these different relationships on the network. So for me, I'm going to think of proof of stake more the Ethereum proof of stake model, which isn't yet in production or anything, but there still is quite some documentation about how it is meant to be working. And as well, you have the Beacon Chain, which is already up. But on the proof of stake network, you have on one side users and stakers similarly. However, stakers can be split up to being either validators or proposers. And so what happens, rather than one miner getting the right to create a block in proof of stake, an algorithm is used to randomly select a group of stakers. One of them gets to be the proposer, and then several other ones get to be the validator. So the proposer says, okay, here is a block with all the transactions in them, and then the randomly selected validators will look at that block and say, okay, that is correct, and you've done it right, so you get the right to propose that block. And everyone's going to follow the rules because they know that one day they may be chosen as the proposer. But so what that effectively does is it creates a couple of more classes and like a couple of more different complications that are also reflective of financial capitalism, I think. So we can think of financial capitalism where finance, insurance, and real estate sectors, so like this FIRE sector of financial products, has gained control of a large part of society, the government, and creating sort of like new rent-seeking opportunities and like incentivizing speculation. A lot of right now capitalism is dependent on credit and the creation of credit. The working class is increasingly exploited by bank debt, student debt, credit card debt. Housing prices have gone up. All of these things are based on financial products, which really, really dominate how we live our lives. And so that isn't to say that it's still capitalism, but it's become a lot more complicated because of all these different interconnected relationships. But so I think it's kind of interesting that proof of work advocates, which are usually Bitcoin maximalists, will argue that proof of stake reflects the current state of the world, in that the rich get richer. Which, to be honest, is like, I think, a fair criticism of proof of stake. There is a lot of similarities to that. And for them, they feel like proof of work is more fair because you can compete as if like it is by merit the amount of work that you put into helping the network. And staking is just about people who were maybe lucky and bought the tokens early, or they already had money, so they're able to purchase enough tokens that they are able to stake. So just to say that on the Ethereum network, you need 32 Ether to be eligible to become a staker, which is at the moment like well over $100,000. So I think there is some truth to that, but I don't think that their criticisms are completely fair in the sense that Bitcoin has the exact same issue, where investors who were early and all these other first movers have a huge advantage over everybody else. If you were just sort of lucky and old enough and interested enough to buy Bitcoin when, you know, it was first starting, and then you sort of just forgot about it, but then you kept your hardware wallet or whatever, then like you've earned a shit ton of money simply because you were a first mover. And you could have just invested like a pretty small amount and now have become very, very wealthy because of it. So I think like the appropriate critique of this debate between proof of work and proof of stake should be similar to the critique of capitalism from a socialist point of view, in the sense that you cannot present both of these options as being the only options, when surely there must be another one that transcends the structure of capitalism itself. And so because we live under the system of capitalism, both proof of work and proof of stake have a lot of issues that are not helpful for the working class to take part in the network. We still have the issue that this is a political and social problem to tackle. And if you want the working class to benefit from this, then the working class needs to be explicitly included in these designs. And so then it becomes kind of difficult when you're talking to other socialists who then say like, oh, proof of work is bad because of environment, and proof of stake is also bad because it's the rich get richer. Because there, at the moment, isn't really like a socialist consensus mechanism out there. And the reason that is because we don't live under socialism. So you can't use the same incentivization mechanisms you would use under capitalism as you would for socialism. What should become a socialist project is to think of what is a consensus mechanism that would fit under socialism. Because right now, these peer-to-peer decentralized distributed networks, they are dependent on these consensus mechanisms, but they rely on capitalism essentially to function and for these incentivization mechanisms to work. In a world where money becomes much less important for your survival and hoarding money becomes much less important, then these systems wouldn't work as well, I think. And so maybe one day, I hope, we'll be able to create some sort of socialist alternative, like proof of solidarity or proof of mutualism or proof of something else, which is like socialist related. And I think that would be a very, very cool project for that to happen. But the only way for that to happen is if for there to be a concerted effort by the left to take on that challenge. So yeah, those are my thoughts. I'm curious what you guys think. Do you think the metaphor makes sense? Do you think it's too flawed to use as something, as a rhetorical device to talk about it with other socialists? Let me know in the comments. And as well, if you like this type of content, be sure to comment as well if you have any other questions that you would directly like me to answer. And again, thanks a lot for your support. It really, really means a lot to me that all of you are my patrons, and your financial support is really something that helps me keep going and keep improving on this project. So yeah, I'll catch you guys later. Thank you.